For the week of September 11th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 118, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, where I hate my DVR, I'm Michael Gills.
Now, why do you hate your DVR?
Well, I love my DVR, of course. It's changed my life, but it's driving me nuts. I've taken it back three times, and it holds very little room on the DVR. I record like three or four, sporting events, and then it's like, oh, you're full up, and it starts erasing things dramatically. I go to other people's houses. They have the same DVR, and they have like 40, 50 hours of high-definition programming, and they still have plenty of room. I'm always struggling to to fit stuff in on my DVR. It drives me nuts. Last night, I tried to record the Yankee game. I set it up. I know I set it up. I come home. It wasn't recording.
Ugh,
I don't know
that's
why.
A nightmare. I hate it when that happens. Now, let me ask you. You're not on a TiVo, I take it.
No. I have the DVR from my cable company.
Okay. Well, I had for years a TiVo from a Series 1 TiVo because I was one of the early adopters. And the thing wouldn't hold, certainly it wouldn't do HD. So that was out of the question. And it would hold 40 hours maybe of television, and it would be erasing stuff all the time. And now I have, a Series 3 TiVo, and it's HD, and I got the extra capacity for it. And mm-hmm. So I still have, the last 8 episodes of Lost to watch, which are recorded on, on the TiVo. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's not a,
It's a sled. Oh, I didn't mean to spoil the ending for you. Anyway.
wow. Okay. That's kind of a callback from, 1941? That you just...
Something like that.
Yes.
Well, why did I bring up the DVR?
Spoiler. Well, I think that you brought up the DVR, in my opinion, because on today's show, we'll be talking to Mark Berman, who is AKA Mr. Television. He's the editor-in-chief of a new online destination, TV Media Insights. Now, he'll be giving us not only a preview of this weekend's Emmy Awards, honoring last year's top television shows, but also a peek at what we have in store for the new television season. Of course, Michael, you've got a slew of publishing news. I don't know where we're going to start with that. And in music, PJ Harvey won a big prize last week. We'll tell you which one. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or a Big Whoop. We'll finish up with some listener email and feedback. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I'm sorry. It was a sleepy weekend at the box office. The lowest weekend of the year, one of the lowest weekends of all time, frankly, wasn't it? $82 million total for the top movies of the weekend. But we're looking at the worldwide box office as always, and the number one movie in the world and in the U.S. was Contagion, which grossed $22.4 million. It opened in the U.S. only, but it's still the top movie around the world.
And of course, it's Steven Soderbergh's final movie, according to...
Well, no. He has a string of movies still in the works. That's not his final film.
Yes, I was just trying to propagate the rumor that keeps spreading.
But I mean, he has other projects. He hasn't said this was his final film. He's said he's nearing the end, but he's had two or three other projects always coming up after Contagion, as well as doing second unit work on The Hunger Games, the young adult novel turned into a feature film. But anyway... Contagion is the number one movie at the box office around the world. Number two is still The Smurfs, $17.3 million it's made. That's $458 million worldwide and counting. And number three around the world is Rise of the Planet of the Apes. That grossed another $16.8 million. It's at $375 million worldwide and counting. And number four, mostly overseas, is Final Destination 5, which grossed another $11.8 million. If you're wondering if there'll be a Final Destination 6, this one grossed $120 million, so you can bet your bottom dollar there will be.
So it really wasn't the Final Destination at all. It was really kind of like just another stop on the way to the Final Destination.
Exactly.
Right.
It's sort of a circle of hell thing.
Okay.
And number five is Friends with Benefits, $9.5 million. That's at $85 million worldwide. And number six, Captain America, the First Avenger, another $9 million. That's just approaching $350 million worldwide. And number seven is The Help, which grossed $8.9 million in the U.S. It started to open overseas, but I can't get any good figures for what it grossed in Australia, so that's really only the U.S. gross. It's at about $140 million worldwide and counting. It still has a long way to go if it's going to work overseas at all. And number eight is Horrible Bosses, which grossed $6 million. That's just about to hit $200 million worldwide. And number nine, The Faltering Cowboys and Aliens, is almost done with its run. It grossed $6 million to top out at $156 million. And at number 10, opening in the U.S. only, is Warrior, the Tom Hardy mixed martial arts movie, which grossed $5.2 million. That was a poor opening, but certainly not the only poor opening of the week.
No, actually, Bucky Larson, Born to be a Star, and Creature ranked among the worst openings of all time.
Bucky Larson is an Adam Sandler penned movie, right?
Yes, I believe so. Well, penned, or he had something to do with it, because Happy Madison, his production company, is credited with bringing it to us. And unfortunately, I don't think they brought it to all of us.
And what the heck is Creature?
I have no idea. That's how poorly that film opened.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
Yes. Well, I mean, look, it's the weekend after Labor Day, traditionally always a... Well, I guess traditionally and always, that's kind of redundant, but it always is kind of a lower box office draw that weekend.
And as I thought, yeah, Adam Sandler is one of the co-screenwriters on that movie, which is about a guy who goes to become a porn star, just like his parents.
Oh, well, doesn't everybody? Everybody follows, and you know, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, my dad was a, well, what was my dad? I don't know.
He was your dad. You
know, there were other movies in the U.S. all grossing under $5 million, a very sleepy weekend. The Debt, the Helen Mirren film, Columbiana, Shark Night 3D, and Apollo 18, Our Idiot Brother. It's just a very, very quiet weekend at the box office. Soon we'll be hitting the fall films, which are all unspooling at the Toronto Film Festival, which unfortunately we're not at this year.
That's right, but we'll try and get somebody next week to talk about it, somebody who was there, maybe a couple of people. Now, just to give you some perspective... $82 million at the domestic box office, right? That's what you said?
Yeah.
Well, okay, and that's across...
That's for the top, like the top 10, 12 movies, not the entire box office, but it's close to it.
Okay, well, then you also have, what, 40,000 screens that's unspooling, you know, that we're talking about there? So let's cut it in half. Let's call it 15,000 screens?
You mean 15,000 movie theaters, or what do you mean?
Screens, not movie theaters.
Why would you cut it in half?
Well, just for argument's sake, because over on Broadway, they had a $15 million week last week, and they don't have nearly 15,000 theaters.
Oh, I see what you mean, yes.
Just to put it in some perspective.
This is a very slow week for Broadway, too.
Right, exactly.
The top shows are grossing $1.2, $1.1 million, as opposed to the $1.8, $1.7, $1.9 million that they can peak out at. So it's a very quiet week on Broadway. The end of summer, the fall season is just starting. Follies just opened up on Broadway. I'm seeing it Wednesday night. It's a revival of the Stephen Sondheim classic. Terrific rave reviews. It stars Bernadette Peters. It's certainly one of the must-see shows of the fall. And coming up soon is The Mountaintop with Samuel L. Jackson and Angela Bassett. That's another hot ticket. He plays Martin Luther King Jr., who's in his hotel room the night after delivering his I Have a Dream speech. And that got great reviews in London. It's come to New York for a limited run, of course. They're both big stars. And that's another show you'll want to jump on a ticket right away.
Now, Samuel L. Jackson, I saw him years and years and years ago in Fences.
Really? Where?
On Broadway.
He stepped into the role in Fences?
I believe so, yes. Was it Fences? I saw him in some Broadway show before he was Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, this was in like 1990.
I think he was always Samuel L. Jackson.
Well, okay, but he wasn't the Samuel L. Jackson that we've all come to know and love. You know, I met him actually like a year after I saw him on Broadway and had to ask who he was. And he introduced himself not as the person who was in Fences on Broadway or whatever Broadway show I'm thinking of, but as the radio DJ from Do the Right Thing.
That's right. That was one of a key early role for him. Samuel L. Jackson was in The Piano Lesson.
That's what it was. I knew that it had something to do with music because there was the logo of a piano on the back of his jacket.
Well, that's another great, August Wilson play. I certainly didn't. I've never seen The Piano Lesson, actually. I haven't even read it. I'm looking forward to a revival someday soon. But that was back in 1990?
Yes. That's how, when I was just an embryo, that's how young I am.
He'd already been in, he'd been in School Days and Do the Right Thing. He'd had a, but really his career was really going to peak up, after Do the Right Thing. So when did he break through? I would say Jungle Fever was probably his first big role. That's when people really started to pay attention to him. And
don't you think people really started to pay attention to him kind of in a household name kind of way after Pulp Fiction?
Well, of course. But Jungle Fever was, he got really good reviews for his role as a crack addict in Jungle Fever. And then he did, he was at the 1991 Cannes Film Festival. They even created a special award for him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now he really broke through there, I think. And then he went on to do, of course, Juice and Patriot Games and fun stuff like National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon and things like that. He was in Jurassic Park,
Yeah, I mean, he's had a terrible career since then. I mean, just awful.
Right.
Well, now, we still have some time before our guest Mark Berman joins us, so do you want to maybe talk about some music news?
Absolutely.
Well, I know you like PJ Harvey, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I've liked her in the past. I mean, To Bring You My Love back in 1995, I think, is a modern classic. I think that's her peak. It's one of the best albums of all time. I've never really felt anything before since then has quite equaled it, but she's certainly a challenging, interesting performer.
Well, her new album is great. which is Let England Shake. And she won the Mercury Prize back in 2001. In fact, on September 11th, 2001, she won that prize and was not able to accept it for obvious reasons. However, this year, she was there in person in the UK to accept this year's Mercury Prize. She won for the second time the big prize. And I think she's the first artist to win two Mercury Prizes.
That's right. And the Mercury Prize is sort of a it's sort of like the Booker Prize in literature. It's sort of picked by a committee. It's very prestigious. It can help boost an artist's standings, especially in the UK and Europe. You know, it's not like a Grammy Award or their equivalent. It's more of a an artistic choice. You know, it's not it's rarely the big blockbuster album of the year. It's usually some rising, incredibly talented artist that can really use the boost of visibility and sometimes established artists like PJ Harvey. So it's a very, very, you know, nice award to win. It really, you know, it feels very special.
Right. Yeah. Well, this was her eighth album, and it was kind of the odds on favorite to win the Mercury Prize this year. So it wasn't a big surprise, but she was kind of
it was to me, because she was a you know, she's an established artist, and they don't always win, and they certainly don't win twice. So this is the first time. So I felt the bookies were wrong, but they were right this time. You know, and her last album that won, Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea, is not one of my favorites of hers. So maybe they're making up for it with this one.
Maybe. Now, of course, the Mercury Prize, like many prizes, you know, given to whether it be a book, an album, or a movie, can often cause a little bit of a bump in sales, but it doesn't always work that way. The little known Speech Debelle, is that how you pronounce that? Debelle? Speech Debelle? Won in 2009, and it still, to this date, only sold 13,000 copies.
I'm not sure how you pronounce that artist's name, but, you know, they've got a great track record. Elbow is a big UK act. Arctic Monkeys made it for their debut. Auntie and the Johnsons, a really terrific act. Dizzy Rascal, a UK rap artist. You know, they've got a good track record. They're really very, very UK-centric. You know, Badly Drawn Boy, Gomez, Talvin Singh. These are artists that haven't always broken out in the U.S., but they are really well-respected and strong-selling in the UK.
Well, now, speaking of strong-selling, you have a ton of publishing news here. I don't even know where to start.
Well, you know, the book industry news is just, you know, in turmoil. You know, we're watching what happened to the music industry and to a degree the film industry happen in the book industry, and I feel it's like happening at the same speed on steroids.
Which is, I guess, why we keep talking about it.
That's right. It's fascinating how they're reacting to the explosion of ebooks and e-readers. I think they're doing a better job than the music industry. They're actively and aggressively trying to make their material available as ebooks. They're not, you know, dragging their feet. They're not scared of it. They're not doing a lot of things they should do, but they are getting better and better and trying to deal with this business. And we're watching print, you know, sales collapse and ebook sales rise. And as always, ebook sales are not making up for the loss in print sales, but it's not as much a gap as you saw in the music industry, where there really was a huge collapse in the amount of money made from album sales. So it's fascinating to watch. One of the things that we saw was, you know, will established authors go solo or start to just, you know, self-publish their own books? Why go through a publisher? And when J.K. Rowling had the rights to her ebooks and was going to release them through her own website, everybody in the industry said, oh, don't worry about that. That doesn't mean anything. She's totally unique. Don't worry about it. Now we have another pretty good best-selling author, Omar Tyrell, who is self-publishing his next book. Now, he's a best-selling author. He has deals with four different publishers. He deals with characters who have who are African-American. He has a strong following in that community and people who just like good, fun, commercial fiction. He has a fiction deal through Simon & Schuster. He has a business book he's doing with Wiley, which is a well-known publishing imprint. He has two books with a smaller imprint called Urban Books, and he has a short story collection coming out that's aimed towards preteens. So he's clearly a brand name author. He clearly works within the industry, and yet he's decided to take his next book, which is called Corrupted, and he is going to release it himself via Kindle as a serial novel, like one chapter a week for 27 weeks. He thinks there'll be about 27 chapters. He's going to charge $1 a chapter and put one out every week.
That's actually a really smart move, and now that I know about it, I'm going to actually download it. Now, it's going to cost me $27.
That's right. It's a lot more than, but it's about what you pay for a hardcover book.
$27? You know. I don't know. Isn't that
on
the high end?
If you go to a store, that's the list price for a hardcover book. You know it's going to the author rather than to a publisher and other things. So when people sort of say, hey, I'll pay you $20 to record your new album, you know, like they do in music now, you know, say PG Harvey went to her fans and said, hey, donate money and I'll give you a free copy of my album. In a way, you're sort of helping Omar Tyrell finance this book. you know, it's a cereal, which makes it sort of fun. But yeah, it's a lot of money. Well, people say, gee, if it was 50 cents or 75 cents, maybe I'd do it. Or maybe I should get two chapters for a dollar. You know, maybe more people would do it. You know,
it's all an experiment. Or if I subscribe to all 27, maybe I pay only $20. So I'm getting seven for free. Or, you know,
right.
So that, yeah.
One of the things I like is he's celebrating the book as, quote, raw and unedited. He's doing the fact that he doesn't have an editor, you know, editing the book is sort of a plus. You know, it's not going to have all that fancy editing. And he's going to, you know, take feedback from readers into account. He might change stuff that he does or change directions or change, you know, characters that he's doing. He says it's sort of a book that falls between genres. It's not pure commercial fiction. It's got some thriller elements or mystery elements to it. And he feels like if he went through a regular publisher, they would, you know, want him to change this or that and make it straightforwardly one thing or another. He says, you know, it came to the idea for the book came to him in May. He wanted to get it out in the summer before fall. And in the book industry, if he had an idea now, it would be coming out summer 2013. You know,
that's right.
He would go to a publisher. He would submit a manuscript. They would edit it. They put it in their catalog. And 9 months after it appeared in the catalog, it would be out on the streets.
Yeah, they have a long lead time in publishing.
They really, really do. And he's still working with major publishers. He has a hardcover from Simon & Schuster, I think, due out in 2012. He sees this as sort of a stopgap, an experiment. It's just fun. It's a buck a chapter, that's true. So it'll be really interesting to see how many of his fans go along for the ride.
Well, yeah, and let's face it, we're talking about it. So it's a great marketing ploy for him. People who had no idea who he was now might know who he is.
Yeah, I mean, can't you see Stephen King doing that?
Oh, absolutely.
Why won't, you know, and he's put out short stories and done other things. You know, why not? He did the serialized novel Green Mile. So, you know, this seems perfect for someone like him.
I've been buying more and more of those little Kindle editions that are just on Kindle. They're sold through Amazon and they're, you know, a dollar or $4 or whatever they might be. I mean, people are publishing some interesting work that way.
What have you bought in that way?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Like expanded newspaper articles or things like that? Or
there was like a 25-page book on Comic-Con that I purchased. And
was it good?
I have yet to read it. I literally purchased it yesterday.
Well, you know, the ease of buying something like that is really addictive. I was in the middle of Hurricane Irene. It was late at night. The storm was raging. No stores were open for miles around me. And I bought Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises and started to read it. You know, I mean, you can. It's so easy.
Okay.
As you won't be surprised to find out that ebook sales are on the rise. They went up 167% in June to $80 million for that month. That's according to 15 top publishing houses that reported figures. The first half of the year, sales are up 161% on ebooks. You know, of course, more and more people are buying the readers every day. Downloadable audio sales are also still up. You know, people are buying audiobooks now in digital format, and they're getting that. They're so used now to buying books as ebooks, I think they're more and more realizing, hey, they can get audiobooks that way as well. And but again, if you look at the big figures for hardcover, trade paperback, mass market, all are taking serious hits. 10, 20, 30% trade paperback sales were the largest. 64% they were down for the first half of the year. Some of that has to do with the closing of borders. Some of that has to do with, you know, other factors. But if you look at all the trade segments together, adding in ebooks, sales were down by about 10% for the first half of the year. So, you know, sales are falling a little bit, but not as dramatically as they have, say, in the music business, at least so far.
Before we move on to what I think is the biggest news in publishing this week, I would say that I guess publishing has gone full circle, because when I read Vanity Fair, which is by William Makepeace Thackeray, the thing was so long, that book. Why? Because it was published in magazines in a serial fashion, so that he had to keep it going to keep getting paid. And, you know,
well, I don't think he necessarily extended the book beyond its natural course. But, you know, that's like saying Dickens and he were all just sort of padding it in to make an extra buck.
Well, soon you'll be able to, I guess, rent those books from Amazon, or maybe just join a Netflix like service that Amazon is preparing, according to The Wall Street Journal. And you'll be able to read all these books. Now, I can't imagine that major publishers will allow new releases to go out this way.
Well, we've been talking about this for a while, that the next obvious evolution is to let people rent books, pay a monthly fee, and be able to access a library of books, you know, a certain number of books, and, you know, go nuts. It provides you a steady income of money. It discourages piracy. It makes a huge library of books available to readers. They've got a massive back catalog of book sales. And traditionally, that's where publishing has made most of their money, however, is in that back catalog. you know, new releases are really just a way to find new books to add to your back catalog. That's sort of their bread and butter. But that's threatened by ebooks in a way, because people demand them very cheaply or not at all. And once books go into public domain, then, you know, it's a free for all. You can't make a lot of money selling Great Expectations when I can go online and buy the complete Charles Dickens for $2, which I have done. This is a very natural evolution. Amazon seems the one that would be in the best position to do it. They are talking to major publishers. They are talking to them about including new releases. You know, it's not supposed to be just books that are 20 or 30 years old. But even if it was books that were more than 10 years old, there'd be a massive library of, you know, great material. It'd be like, you know, people can go to the library now and, you know, borrow books, and more of them are going to be available as ebooks or physical books right now. Well, getting them to pay for that rather than going to the library and doing it for free, that should be a no-brainer in a way. So you would think they'd have no resistance to doing, you know, books that are more than 10 years old. But of course, they're nervous, they're scared, they don't know what it means, they're afraid of upending their business. I think it's fascinating. I think at the very least, you might consider doing it with your full catalog. It's where you make a lot of money. There's so many ways they need to better publish books. Well, you know, I went to the store 2 days ago to buy The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by Jean Le Carré, the thriller writer. It was a BBC miniseries. It's a new movie. It got great reviews overseas, and I'm looking forward to it. I thought I'll read the book. It's the first part in a trilogy. I've considered multiple times buying this book, but I walk into the store. They have a new edition out tied into the movie. It's a trade paperback, so it's big and heavy. It's $16.
Wow.
And it is a 37-year-old novel, and it's part of a trilogy, and it's $16. They want me to pay $48 to buy three books that are, you know, four decades old.
Well, mark my words, what you'll see with all of these subscription services, whether it be Netflix or this whatever Amazon is putting together here, at some point somebody will buy all these companies and then bundle them all together, and you'll have these like triple play offerings. You know, you can get your movies and your books for the low price of $15 a month.
Well, that's the thing I have with my TV, though. I'm paying for a phone that I don't want and about 600 channels I never watch, just to get about 40 channels and my Wi-Fi. But they call it triple play, and they charge me $160 a month.
Well, Michael, maybe we should try and find out what is on some of those 600 channels that you're not watching. And we could do that by talking to Mark Berman, who has been an expert on TV and especially TV ratings for many years. Mark Berman is known as Mr. Television. He is the editor-in-chief for TV Media Insights, which is a new online destination for television and media. It's got a homepage, a newsletter, a forum, a podcast, and much more. I don't know how you find time to sleep, Mark. That launched on September 6th. Prior to TV Media Insights, Berman was the creator and editor of the Programming Insider, an online Bible for trade magazine Media Week that reached more than 50,000 readers per day and focused on any and all information pertaining to television. Mark, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, I've been a fan of your stuff for years. I used to follow the Programming Insider and get your daily email newsletter. I encourage anyone who loves television and loves TV ratings like I do to go to TVMediaInsights.com and sign up for that newsletter. It's been a lot of changes for you.
Thank you.
One of the big changes recently is that you started adding in overnights on cable television programming. I used to always wonder how cable television shows like The Jersey Shore or, you know, Top Chef and things were doing on cable, but there was no easy way to get numbers unless they were one of the top 10 or 15 shows of the week, at least for folks like me who don't get, you know, the Nielsen numbers. So I was wondering how you were able to suddenly start adding that into the mix of information that you could provide to readers.
Well, you know, it's a very different world when you have the broadcast networks. It's completely different. I come in the morning, the overnights come in about between 8:30 and 9, and there I am typing away. Cable, it's not that accessible, and it still really isn't at this point. But when I came over here 2 weeks ago, I made this conscious effort that I want to do more cable. So what I try to do every day is I do what I call a cable scorecard. It's not as timely as the broadcast networks, but I'm getting there with it. It's just the data is just not as readily available for cable yet, but that should hopefully change.
Well, I figured those people were just hiding the figures and they didn't want people to know as much, you know, because the wording I always had was that like HBO, they didn't want to publicize it because they didn't want people to know that we're only, you know, 1 million or 2 million people watching, you know, Arliss or whatever. And they figured it was more prestigious for people not to know. And they said, well, it doesn't matter what our ratings are. We just want loyal viewers, that sort of thing. Like, I don't even know how Game of Thrones was doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The rule of thumb is if you don't hear from anybody, that's not a good sign. when something does well, they're jumping off the rafter. They're off the rooftop screaming. If you don't hear anything, it didn't do well. Broadcast is different than networks because the data is sitting there, and people like myself can crunch it. On cable, it's a little sneakier. Same thing with syndication, I'll be honest with you. This morning I came in. There were four new first-run syndicated series. I was typing up the numbers, and one of the distributors called me trying to hide the facts. I'm like, I have the numbers right here. What are you saying? I can look at them. So it's a very, very sneaky business.
One of those shows was, of course, Anderson Cooper's daytime talk show. Who did the best of those four new launches?
Anderson Cooper did the best, but I wouldn't be, if I was at Warner Brothers, I wouldn't be popping open the bottles of champagne yet. In the overnight markets, it aired in 53 markets. It averaged a 1.2 rating. It held the lead in, which is positive. The year-ago time period dropped by 14%. So not a bad start, but certainly not a wonderful start. I mean, it did inherit some of the Oprah time periods. There was a lot of publicity this summer, so it could have been better, but it's only one day.
That's right. So it'll be a long time before we can really make long-term judgments about how it does. But we can make judgments about last season's shows by looking at the Emmy Awards. The Emmys take place on Sunday, September 18th. One of the big categories, of course, is Best Drama. Five of the six shows nominated for Best Drama have never won before. Does that mean you expect Mad Men to win yet again? Or will TV have a new top drama like maybe Boardwalk Empire, which won a lot of Emmys at the technical awards that were given out last week?
I think Mad Men is going to step down. This year it's going to go to Boardwalk Empire. And I say that simply, I mean, it won seven trophies, as you just said, at the Creative Arts Emmys. It's gotten a lot of buzz. It's an HBO show. At this point, Mad Men needs to step down, and I'm going with Boardwalk Empire.
And now there's also Dexter, Friday Night Lights in its last season, and Game of Thrones over on HBO, and The Good Wife on CBS. But you're saying, doesn't matter, Boardwalk Empire.
Doesn't matter. I mean, Friday Night Lights, I finally got nominated in the category. It took 5 years.
Yeah.
It's like a swan song. You know, I don't think it's going to win. The Good Wife, 2 years old, not ready at this point. And Dexter and Game of Thrones, no. I'm putting my money on Boardwalk Empire.
I would think if there is an upset, it might be The Good Wife, just because it's the only network show.
Well, I think this year, the real surprise last year that Juliana Margulies did not win the Emmy, that was a shock. I think this year she'll win.
Well, are there any races that you think might be too close to call? Any categories?
You know, if you look at lead actor in a comedy series, I mean, last year Jim Parsons won, and rightfully so. This year, it's the final, you know, the final season of The Office for Steve Carell. Is it time for him to come down? You know, come to the stage. I don't think Johnny Galecki will win. I think certainly Jim Parsons is higher profile than him. I don't expect Louis C.K. to win, but Alec Baldwin, who I believe has already won three times, you know, the Emmys love to repeat themselves, and there's a very good shot that he'll win. And then, you know, a sleeper could be Matt LeBlanc. You know, episodes on Showtime, it got a lot of creative buzz. And, you know, it's possible. It's very, you know, it's very possible. And then, you know, if you go to the category of outstanding comedy series, you know, it could be any. It really, you know, I'm picking Modern Family. I think it definitely is going to win again. But then again, you know, 30 Rock has won this several times. Glee, a lot of people thought would win last year. It didn't. So, it's anyone's game there. But I'm going to go with Modern Family, I think, in that category.
Well, once upon a time, a big Emmy win could really make a difference for a show like Hill Street Blues or Cagney and Lacey. What show do you think could get the biggest boost from the Emmys this year?
You know, I remember way back when, going before those shows, All in the Family. You know, this was a show that premiered in January of 1970 or 71, and it just had no audience. A lot of people were talking, but nobody was watching. And then it won a load of Emmys, and then suddenly people really, really gave it attention. It doesn't work as it doesn't have that much of an impact as it used to have. I would say, looking at the categories, if you go to the comedy series, I mean, The Big Bang Theory already has a certain a large audience. Parks and Recreation, I don't think it's going to win. If it did win, maybe it might, you know, get some new eyeballs. It certainly does not do very well in the ratings. You know, look at 30 Rock. It's won, I believe, three times. It really hasn't helped at that point. Elsewhere, you know, The Good Wife already has a solid audience. Mad Men, you know, the funny thing about Mad Men, it's won three times. This is not a ratings hit. You know, people don't realize that it just doesn't really do well in the ratings, and winning the Emmy has not helped it.
The biggest hit on AMC is The Walking Dead, which, of course, did not get nominated. Why did The Walking Dead get overlooked? Is it because it's a horror show?
They consider it a generic drama. They don't consider it anything creative. You know, the Emmys has a funny way of looking at things sometimes. You know, like a show like The Big Bang Theory, this is the first year it's nominated for Outstanding Comedy. I think it should have been nominated in the very beginning, but it wasn't because, you know, people just look at it, oh, it's just a generic comedy, which it really is not. Then, you know, you have a show like Justified on FX. You know, Margot Martindale's nominated. I mean, the show didn't really generate much interest. Would it help? You know, it's really, at this point, it doesn't really have that much of an influence as it used to. The times have changed.
And then you have shows like Bones, which are, you know, success year after year, and maybe it's waning a little bit, but they never get nominated for anything.
No, you have the CSIs don't get nominated. You know, Bones doesn't get nominated. There was a truckload of shows that just, you know, look at a show like Two and a Half Men. I mean, yes, Charlie Sheen has been nominated. John Cryer is nominated. But the show itself does not get nominated. You know, you don't have to win Emmys to be a success. And then sometimes, you know, a show like Law & Order SVU, it took many years for Marissa Hargitay to get nominated and ultimately win. The show itself never gets nominated. You know, so it's interesting how they come up with it.
Well, I know one show that I like. We're both fans of traditional, comedies, you know, three-camera comedies. Raising Hope is a really good comedy that I'd love to see. It looked like it got some good Emmy love. Got lead actress in a comedy. Cloris Leachman got a nomination, but she was nominated in a very odd category. She's a permanent member of the cast. She appears on most episodes, and she was nominated in the guest star category.
And she lost to Gwyneth Paltrow at the Creative Arts Emmys.
Who was, of course, an actual guest star because she had an arc on Glee.
That's right.
That was very odd. That was very odd. I mean, yes, Martha Plimpton is nominated. I think the surprise nominee for Outstanding Actress was Melissa McCarthy from Mike and Molly, a show that I happen to like. You know, the Emmys normally don't give the Emmy love to those kind of shows. But that's an interesting category also. I mean, it's anyone's game. You know, Tina Fey has won this several times. Edie Falco has already won. I'm going to pick Laura Linney. I think she's going to win for the Big C.
Well, she should be a good choice. And Melissa McCarthy, of course, was on Gilmore Girls, a show that was always ignored by the Emmys, even though it was terrific.
Always.
God knows
always
why.
Always. Everybody crowed and raved and whatever, and it never got any attention. Never.
I think the biggest news, I think, from the Emmy nominations is that the major networks don't seem to matter that much anymore when it comes to quality. They're completely out of the TV, movie, and miniseries category, and now dramas are dominated by cable as well. Is comedy next?
No, because the good news about comedy is coming up this fall, there's 11 new sitcoms. That's a very good sign. That's the most we've seen in 5 years. The networks are realizing that they don't want to abandon this format. It's too important. It's too potentially financially beneficial. So you don't want to walk away from it. So no, comedies are not dead. We've heard that before. I mean, if you go back to 1984.
No, they're not dead. I'm just wondering if cable is going to beat out the networks when it comes to quality.
Oh, in terms of quality. Well, you know, you have to remember this about cable versus the broadcast networks. It's an unfair comparison. When you're a network like ABC, CBS, or NBC, you're filling 22 hours of the week on a schedule. I mean, not everything's original. I mean, the networks have abandoned Saturday, so minus that night. It's a lot of hours to fill. Cable doesn't have that. You know, they have more. Their luxury is they have fewer programs. They don't order as many episodes. A full season on cable generally is 13 episodes. On the broadcast networks, it's 22. So they have it's a whole different ballpark. So they could focus more on the quality of the show. They could do better programming than the broadcast networks traditionally can. It doesn't mean that the broadcast networks don't do good shows. Look at Modern Family. Look at a show like The Good Wife. But cable in the quality department has a built-in advantage. Absolutely.
Well, on cable, you can do a show like Wilfred.
You can do a show like Wilfred. You can get away with more on cable. And then, you know, the viewer has a different perception of cable. You ask an average viewer on the street, where would you go for quality programming? They're going to say cable. They're not going to say the broadcast networks. They're just not.
Well, hopefully they'll be going to the broadcast networks in the fall because there are a lot of new shows coming out. The biggest buzz for a returning show, I would say, has to be Two and a Half Men. I know you're a fan of the classic traditional comedy. How will Two and a Half Men do with Ashton Kutcher in the lead role?
Well, let me tell you something. I think it's going to kick off. My prediction is it's going to kick off with over 20 million viewers. I'm going to go with about 22 to 23 million. People are going to be sitting there watching in curiosity. I think once the dust settles, I think the show is going to do as well as it did last season. I don't think it's going to lose any steam at all. I really don't.
Well, the biggest new show, of course, is The X Factor. Is Fox doing a good job of balancing the needs of the number one show in the country, which is American Idol, while launching a big competitor to American Idol, which is X Factor?
Yes, they are. Fox is poised for its highest rated fourth quarter in the history of the network. I do not think doing the X Factor in the fall and bringing back American Idol is overkill. Viewers can't get enough of these type of singing competitions. There's an endless hunger for it. Plus, Simon Cowell is back. We didn't see him last year on American Idol. He's reuniting with Paula Abdul. I think this will be the biggest new hit of the season, and that disappoints me, actually. It's very disappointing because of the 27 new shows, only two are non-scripted, and The X Factor will clearly be the highest rated, without a doubt.
Are you saying you just wish that it wasn't a non-scripted show that was going to be the biggest hit of the fall?
Yes, yes, yes. I'd like to see a scripted show walk away with the top-rated honors. I mean, you know, we have so much reality now. We have so many singing competitions. There's so much of this. There's an endless glut of it. So to have a new show come on that's going to stand well above anything else that's non-scripted, to me, is a disappointment. I would have rather seen a scripted show get that honor, but it's not going to happen.
Well, now, looking at the networks this year, the shows that are being announced, what are some of your favorite shows? On ABC, I guess we can take it network by network. On ABC, we have Last Man Standing, Man Up, Suburgatory, or is that...
Yes, Suburgatory.
Revenge, Charlie's Angels, Once Upon a Time, and Pan Am, which is kind of a Mad Men ripoff. So out of those, right, are there any that we should really be paying attention to?
No, ABC, if you're doing an office pool to see which will be the first cancellation, I would choose Once Upon a Time. I have no idea what that show's about. It makes no sense to me. Charlie's Angels is a revival, and it's not very good. The comedies on Tuesday, Last Man Standing and Man Up, I admire ABC for attempting it. It's going to be very tough for them to launch a night with unproven comedies. Suburgatory has a shot because it's out of the middle and into Modern Family, so it's positioned well. I admire the fact that Revenge dares to be different. It's the story of a woman seeking revenge on some people that did wrong to her family. But it's facing CSI and it's facing Law & Order SVU, and chances are it's not going to work.
What about Pan Am?
My prediction is by midseason, Pan Am will be gone or moved elsewhere, and ABC will put in one of their midseason shows, and the show is Good Christian Bells. They need something to replace it with Desperate Housewives. I like the fact that Pan Am, again, dares to be different. It's set in the 1960s at the Pan Am Airlines. I think there'll be some curiosity. I don't think it's going to work once the dust settles.
It's funny, but you know, the movie studios have a great track record of remakes and reboots of old films and old film franchises, or taking TV shows and turning them into movies. It doesn't always work, of course, but they do it all the time. TV has a terrible track record of rebooting old shows. It almost never works, it seems like.
It basically never works, but I'll tell you one thing that shocked me. There's a new version of Dallas coming up on TNT. When I first heard it, my eyes were rolling. Not, please don't do this. They sent me the pilot. I was blown away.
Really? Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I'm excited.
It was really, really good. You know, you have a show like Hawaii Five-0 that got through the first season. It's not a big hit. 90210 has been limping along now for 3 years. More often than not, that, you know, like we had a new Melrose Place. It came and went. You know, we had a new Love Boat. We had a new Fantasy Island. It goes on and on. They normally do not work. We had a new Bionic Woman. Didn't work. Leave well enough alone.
Now, on CBS, we have Two Broke Girls, Unforgettable, How to Be a Gentleman, Person of Interest, and A Gifted Man are the new series that CBS is offering. Anything worth watching here?
Yes. Two Broke Girls, I think, is very funny. It's positioned very well out of How I Met Your Mother and into Two and a Half Men. I think Person of Interest has a good shot. It's sitting in the CSI time period. It's a high-profile hour. CBS is looking for some new energy on the night. It does have a chance. How to Be a Gentleman, I personally didn't like it. But it airs out of the Big Bang Theory, so it has good lead and support. But then again, Bleep My Dad Says was there, and that didn't work.
That's right.
Unforgettable. Unforgettable airs Tuesday at 10 out of NCIS Los Angeles. It leads out of a solid show, which means it will get sampled. But because CBS is in such good shape, it doesn't guarantee it's going to stay on the air. If I had to pick one show of the five on CBS, I'm picking Two Broke Girls. I'm optimistic about Person of Interest. And Unforgettable and How to Be a Gentleman do have a shot. Forget about A Gifted Man. It won't be gifted once the ratings come in. Forget it.
Now, over on NBC, the Troubled Network, the Playboy Club, Up All Night, Free Agents, Whitney, Prime Suspect, and Grimm are the new series. Anything in that list that we should be looking out for?
Yes, I think the one show that stands out on NBC is Prime Suspect. NBC was smart to trim back the three-hour sitcom block to two. There's an endless hunger for crime solving. This is a proven format outside of the U.S. I definitely think it'll be sampled. The one thing to keep in mind that it's going to skew older. They're going to get a lot of 50-plus viewers that the networks don't want. On the Playboy Club, I give the network credit. It's unusual looking. I think, you know, it's gotten publicity. I think it will get sampled. I think once everything settles in, it's going to be on. It's going to be in the middle. I don't expect it to be a flop. I don't expect it to be a hit. The comedies on Wednesday are like ABC on Tuesday. They're not proven. They're anchoring a night. That's very hard to do. Whitney, the pilot, was atrocious. But it's out of The Office, which guarantees some sampling. Grimm will be one of the first cancellations of the season. Bizarre.
I found the Playboy Club very boring. But I'm more interested in Fox. We know Fox has The X Factor. The other shows they have are New Girl, the Zooey Deschanel comedy, another sitcom called I Hate My Teenage Daughter, a sketch show, Alan Gregory, which has already aired, and the big one is Terra Nova. Which of those, after The X Factor, do you think is of any interest?
Well, New Girl, the pilot was very good. It's getting a lot of buzz. It airs out of Glee, so it has young adult support. I don't expect it to be a ratings hit because Raising Hope wasn't in that time period, but I think it has potential. There's a show called I Hate My Teenage Daughter that airs out of The X Factor, which means it will get sampled. But I think it's going to lose a lot of the audience. Terra Nova, I wouldn't have scheduled at 8 o'clock on Monday. I think it's too early in the week. I didn't love the pilot. I mean, obviously it's dinosaurs. People will be curious. There's been a lot of ink written about it. I think once the season settles in, it'll be a modest performer. But the nice thing about Fox's lineup, they really have nothing that looks, none of their new shows look like flops. Even Alan Gregory, which is animated, it's out of The Simpsons on Sunday. So, you know, if we're having a conversation, if they filmed us and made us a cartoon and put us after The Simpsons, we'll do okay.
That's a good idea.
You know?
And then finally, there's CW, which has Heart of Dixie, Ringer, Hater, which has already debuted, and probably the best one of the bunch, The Secret Circle.
Right. Well, Hater hasn't premiered yet. Hater's coming up. The thing about Hater is, look, it's a silly reality show with Mario Lopez. If you hate a celebrity, that celebrity's on your doorstep. So it's kind of cute, kind of fun. I think they'll leave it on the air simply because it's so inexpensive. I think the two potential positives on the CW, and this is the most number of new shows they've ever launched, Ringer, which premieres tonight at 9 o'clock out of 90210, which is with Sarah Michelle Gellar, and that was originally developed for CBS, and The Secret Circle on Thursday. It's basically vampires into witches on Thursday. It fits. So I'm optimistic about that. Heart of Dixie has no shot. And Hater really is just filling an hour temporarily. You know, I mean, obviously the themes this season are there's more comedies, there's a lot of crime, the revivals, and then there's The X Factor.
Right, and I think that's really the story is, and then there's The X Factor.
Do you think there's any chance it won't do as well as American Idol? But in overall, it has to be a really exciting time to cover TV, thanks to DVRs and Hulu and old TV shows being available on DVD and YouTube, and now people sooner will be able to watch TV on their tablet or their smartphone. It's just a really fun, exciting time, and there's so much quality television all over network and cable. It's really fascinating.
It is fascinating. There's a lot to watch. There's a lot of options, you know, depending on what your tastes are. It's exciting for me because the summer's boring, and now there's a lot of new stuff coming on. So, yeah, I'm hoping to see some new hit blood, and I'm excited about some of the new products. I mean, it's not the best season I've seen. It's not the worst. Hopefully something will click, and we'll have a good season.
Well, thank you very much for filling us in on some of the shows we should be watching, as well as which categories we should pay special attention to on Sunday evening during the Emmy Awards. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
Now, we can find your blog. Is there a URL we should be sending people to?
Yes, they could go to www.tvmediainsights.com. I have the numbers up. We have an interactive blog. We have breaking news. There's a lot there, a lot to look at. I hope everyone will join me.
Now, I believe you're also on Twitter.
Yes, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everywhere.
Well, we'll place links to all of your social media accounts as well as your website in our show notes. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Bye.
Well, that was great of Mark Berman to take the time to talk with us at TVMediaInsights.com. He's knows his stuff.
Yeah, he does. I mean, when you want to know, it's always great to speak with him. Whenever you want to know something about television, he's definitely one of the key people to turn to.
The one thing I'm surprised about is his thing about All in the Family. He said that it started off very, very slow. That's true. I did not know that. It debuted in 1970, and it was ranked number 34 in the ratings. And then It got tons of attention for the show. Of course, it was so controversial, and then got all those Emmy nominations. It moved to Saturday night at 8 o'clock, and it exploded suddenly. Next season, 1971-72, was number one. It was the first show to be number. It was one of the few shows to be number one 5 years in a row,
which was a big deal back then.
That's right. The Idol has now passed that, and the Cosby Show, to be number one more than 5 years in a row. But it's a big deal any time to be number one 5 seasons in a row. And I didn't know that it got off to a slow start like that and that the Emmys had helped it. So that's good to know.
Well, since we're talking about big deals, we may as well move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, the NFL season opener on Sunday Night Football was a massive hit in the ratings, scoring the biggest numbers in 15 years. For Sunday night overall, NBC had the biggest average rating for a network since ABC hosted the Academy Awards in February. It scored a 16.9 Nielsen in the overnights and gave NBC bigger ratings than the other three networks combined. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal because this is the only good news NBC has. Oftentimes, it's the only show in the top 10 or even the top 20 for NBC. That's Sunday Night Football and the pregame show. That's it. That's all they have. My favorite network growing up is just in terrible disarray. And we just heard from Mark Berman. You look at the fall pilots, many of which I've seen, like the Playboy Club, and there's no good news there. So they need Sunday Night Football to do well because that's the only happy news that they have.
In completely related news, football garnered big bucks at NBC. Ads for the Super Bowl on February 5th are selling for a record $3.5 million per 30-second spot, and at ESPN, they re-upped their contract on Monday Night Football for another 8 seasons at a total of nearly $2 billion. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Sports programming is one of the last bastions of big ticket prices. You can get young men, which are very hard to capture. It guarantees a live audience. People don't DVR sports as much as they do television programs. CSI or whatever it might be. So it's very, very valuable. And they're going to keep paying top dollar for it. Even as the network ratings get a little smaller over the years, it just makes those eyeball events like the Oscars and big football games all the more valuable.
In What Were They Thinking news, Mel Gibson blithely is courting controversy with his next movie project. Gibson plans to direct an epic film about the Jewish folk hero Judah Maccabee. Some 150 years ago, before Christ, Maccabee led a revolt against an empire that refused to allow the Jews to worship and live as they choose. Maccabee embraced classic guerrilla warfare, whittling away at his enemy and winning people over to his cause the longer they survived. Maccabee has been portrayed in poetry and song and even comic books. Hanukkah celebrates the return of the Jews to worship at the temple in Jerusalem after Maccabee removed pagan idols. In other words, he's been a big deal, and having Gibson, whose film The Passion of the Christ is filled with anti-Semitic imagery and dialogue, and who has proven repeatedly insensitive to Jews and other minorities in comments over the years, has infuriated major Jewish groups. No word yet on whether Gibson would play Maccabee, but he's a very braveheart sort of fellow, so who knows? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Mel Gibson has a good track record as a director. His movies make a lot of money. This is where, he lives now as a director, as a star. His star has waned for quite a while now. It's an absolutely bizarre idea for a major studio, Warner Brothers, to partner with him on this. Most of his projects, Mel Gibson has been self-financing. So if he wanted to make Judah Maccabee, he could. But for a studio to say, hey, let's take this guy who's known for his anti-Semitic comments to make a movie celebrating a Jewish folk hero, it could have been an opportunity for Gibson to say, hey, I want to make amends and celebrate a Jewish folk hero. But instead, it's being done in such a way that it's just offending, major Jewish groups who've been very unhappy with Gibson and his refusal to really do what they consider a sincere apology and make amends for what he's done in the past.
Well, I would second everything you just said, so I'm just going to move right along to the Kennedy Center honorees, which are usually a safe pick, a career-capping honor for artists who have clearly excelled in their field. This year's batch is no different. It includes one actress, one singer, and one pop star, one classical musician, and one jazz icon. Meryl Streep may not have won an Oscar since Sophie's Choice back in 1982, but now she's joining the Kennedy Center honor roll. I am deeply honored by this news and wish my mother and father were alive to hear it, Streep said in a statement. She's joined by Barbara Cook, Neil Diamond, Yo-Yo Ma, and Sonny Rollins. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the sense that there are no bizarre surprises or, people pulled out of nowhere to get this honor. These are all a major established artist who have great careers behind them who absolutely deserve it. You know, Neil Diamond's made some of the best albums of his career recently. Meryl Streep is still going strong. Barbara Cook still delivers some great, you know, performances. And Yo-Yo Ma and Sonny Rollins are also still quite relevant. So it's nice. They're not people who are sort of retired and in the old folks home. They're all quite active in their field still. So it feels like a particularly vibrant Kennedy Center year, I think.
Well, I think, wasn't it last year or the year before they gave it to Bruce Springsteen, who is still vibrant as well?
Yeah, he still packs them in, doesn't he?
Yeah. The film adaptation of Les Misérables is heating up. Hugh Jackman will play Jean Valjean in the adaptation of the smash hit musical to be directed by Tom Hooper of The King's Speech. William Nicholson is writing the new book. Oh, he's a good writer. Though the songs will remain the same. Helena Bonham Carter is possible for the comic relief of the scheming Mrs. How do you pronounce that?
Thénardier.
Mrs. Thénardier. And as the relentless Inspector Javert, Russell Crowe is in deep talks, or is deep in talks. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. It sounds like a really good cast so far. Russell Crowe does have a rock band, so he's not he's not unknown for singing. Hugh Jackman, of course, has been done quite well in the theater, in musical theater. He made his big break in Oklahoma, a revival in the UK. So, you know, they're big names, big stars. This is, you know, one of my favorite musicals. I really want them to do it right. And it'll be interesting to see what I really want to hear about is that they're going to make it like 4.5 hours. You know, I want them to do the whole musical. Don't cut anything. If there's an intermission, I'll know they're on the right level.
Now, advocates of fair use and open source have been arguing for years that the U.S. has been pushing other countries into exorbitant legal battles against piracy and casual downloading of even minimal amounts of music, movies, and the like. Now that they have their proof. In the latest batch of WikiLeaks documents, cables from the U.S. Embassy to the Swedish government show the U.S. giving the Swedes marching orders on the laws they need to pass and the steps they need to take to squash or quash any possibility of piracy in order to maintain good relationships with the U.S. Numerous new laws and regulations, including 3 strikes and you're disconnected from the Internet forever rules, were passed that echo exactly what the U.S. demanded. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It seemed to be a never-ending source of interest in what comes out from the WikiLeaks documents, the things that we find out about. It's a very complicated issue. We'll have a link in our show notes if you want to go read a lot more about what was revealed in the NBC cables that we've been looking at. You know, it's natural that the U.S. would want to protect their, you know, entertainment's a big business, and they want other countries to fight against piracy. The question is when they go overboard and too far in quashing personal freedoms and personal rights in doing so.
Well, and of course, Sweden being important because that's where the Pirate Bay and the founders of the Pirate Bay were located.
That's right.
Right. In the upcoming James Bond film, aka Bond 23, Daniel Craig has been blocked by India's railway minister from doing a stunt. Wait, what? In the proposed scene, Bond would have jumped from a motorcycle onto a moving train, and then from that train to another train. Both of them would have depicted passengers riding on the roof of the trains, an image familiar from movies for decades. But the head of the railways says such travel is illegal in India, even though he also admitted it happens pretty much all the time. So no shot of Bond pushing through crowds of people riding in the very cheap seats in his next movie. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously. It's a very minor thing. But I love the guy's quote where he said, "There are many trains in India, and not all trains have people traveling on the rooftops." That was his explanation for why he wanted to block the scene. It seems rather silly, frankly, but what are you going to do?
Writer Aaron Sorkin is back on TV after the flop of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip and the runaway success of the feature film The Social Network. Sorkin is returning to the weekly grind of crafting a show by doing yet another behind-the-scenes workplace drama. The source of all his TV shows from Sports Night, the back room at ESPN, to The West Wing, the back room of the White House, to Studio 60, the back room of Saturday Night Live. Guess what? Where is he headed now? To the back room of putting on a cable news show akin to Keith Olbermann. Jeff Daniels is going to star on the 10 episodes ordered by HBO, and you can expect Sorkin to indulge his desire for speechifying on the day's events to his heart's delight. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. He has a great track record, especially, of course, The West Wing, and it's a fun cast. It seems tailor-made for what Aaron Sorkin loves to do, even more so than The West Wing. You know, get to have a guy on a cable news channel give his, you know, nightly commentary. It'll just free him up to do very naturally what he loves to do. I'll definitely be watching.
You get a cable channel, and you get a cable channel, and you get a cable channel. Everybody gets a cable channel. Apparently, your very own cable channel is the latest Hollywood accessory. Following in the footsteps of Oprah Winfrey and Tyler Perry, American Idol host and Dick Clark wannabe Ryan Seacrest is in talks to acquire his own cable channel. He and AIG are in talks to take over VH1's sadly neglected VH1 Soul spinoff and turn it into an entertainment, lifestyle, pop culture thingamajig. It would be one more item on the plate for Seacrest, who hosts the number one show in America, American Idol, is the face of E, has his radio shows, and produces reality hits like The Kardashians or Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Apparently, the man does not sleep. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop until we see what they do with the cable channel. It's not going to be called Ryan, unfortunately. That would be great. It would be funny. It's not going to be Ryan Seacrest or anything like that. But, you know, he's a very, very smart behind-the-scenes talent, and he's also a very good host of American Idol. He deserved his Emmy many years ago. I don't know why Jeff Probst keeps winning.
I don't understand it, but
he does, and he won it again this week. But it's interesting. You know, it's easier to buy a cable channel that already exists than to try and launch a new one and get people to carry it.
Spotify in your car? That's the future, at least if you own a Ford. Spotify, the music streaming service, has partnered with Ford to demonstrate how easy it is to integrate Spotify into Ford's new in-car media system, because you really want to be watching television as you drive down the freeway at 60 miles per hour. It's not an official partnership yet. Spotify won't come loaded in your Ford car, for example. But clearly, the companies are working together, and Spotify can expect a leg up when it comes to getting offered easily in new cars down the road. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for Spotify, because the best way to get into people's cars is to be offered at the dealership. You know, that's how it worked for satellite radio. That's how it can work for Spotify. So it's a very important partnership that they're launching with Ford.
Right. And it just goes to show that there is some competition for satellite radio and traditional radio and even Pandora.
That's right.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we have a story that really is inside baseball. It's about, I guess, The Hollywood Reporter versus Deadline.com, but more specifically versus Nikki Fink, the head of Deadline.
That's right. Legal letters have been sent. The gloves are off. I mean, Deadline.com is an online website, of course, and they've been going back and forth on The Hollywood Reporter and claiming that The Hollywood Reporter is in financial straits, are going to have to start firing people, laying them off, this, that, and the other thing. And The Hollywood Reporter has taken action and publicly sent them a letter and posted it online.
Well, actually, they did it privately. They sent it to Deadline.com's publisher and owner, and then Nikki Fink decided to make it public.
I thought The Hollywood Reporter posted it. Where do you go?
Nikki Fink posted it, and then she posted her response to them, which to the lawyers for The Hollywood Reporter, which started with something, I think you can take this letter and shove it up your, you know, insert profane word there.
So the letter began, Deadline.com is now engaging conduct on your behalf, speaking to the corporate owners of it, that crosses the line from her usual bad behavior to a concerted and unlawful attempt to disrupt The Hollywood Reporter's business. They said Ms. Fink falsely has told The Hollywood Reporter advertisers and others in the Hollywood community that The Hollywood Reporter's experienced financial problems that will cause it to make massive layoffs, end its print edition, and or go out of business or be sold by Prometheus. None of this is true. And then they retort some claims. They say, by the way, we get 4.39 million unique visitors in July of 2011. You only got 1.5 million visitors. We've beaten you handily in traffic for over a year now. Our website traffic has increased 131%. More than the 100% faster than Deadline.com. Our revenue's up 40% year over year. But we've got 48 ad pages in our latest issue, which is about 50% of the book. So nah, nah, nah. So what did Nikki Fink say in response?
Well, she was basically, she had her own list of items that she was saying, you know, they laid off people just this week, that the advertising pages are down, that they went from a daily trade publication to a weekly business, well, kind of consumer-based publication, kind of like
right, they're trying to compete with Us Weekly and people like that.
Right, that particular item, that particular product is not doing well, the magazine, which they just gave me a free subscription out of nowhere. They emailed me and said, here's your Hollywood Reporter subscription for this week and for the next year. And I thought, well, I didn't even ask for this, but okay, why not?
So is The Hollywood Reporter going to take any other steps, or what do we think will be the next stage?
I don't know. I think that basically this was the Hollywood Reporter's way of, I guess they knew that Nikki Fink was going to make a big public scene out of this. And once she did, they kind of went with it and said, hey, you know what? We want people to know that we're not in trouble, that we're actually doing quite well, that advertising revenue is up, page views are up. So the traffic to our website is up. We've got more readers than ever. And, you know, she's been running around telling everybody that we're on the verge of collapse. Well, since she wanted to make this public, we will publicly state all of these facts.
So you think they have the facts on there? You think they make a better argument than Nikki Fink?
She was really upset that a lot of the entertainment journalists at The Hollywood Reporter were stealing quote-unquote exclusives off of Deadline and then running them on The Hollywood Reporter. What I would have to say to that is, welcome to entertainment journalism in the year of 2011, because that's pretty much what happens all the time now.
But that's not accepted behavior. You're supposed to credit the person that broke the story.
Right. You are supposed to credit... you're supposed to source the story. And that's exactly what she was complaining about. And so most of her comeback or retort to this letter was personal attacks. And maybe that sounds negative, but, was aimed at very specific instances or people. Whereas The Hollywood Reporter was talking about the business as a whole. So I thought The Hollywood Reporter's way of approaching this was much more professional.
So what does this mean for readers? I don't think the Hollywood Reporter magazine is doing well at all. Like, I don't know what metrics they have, but I don't know anybody who reads it. It doesn't look interesting or good. I don't think they have an identity or anything that makes sense as far as a business model. So I wouldn't be surprised if the print edition was not doing well. But I say that purely as a personal opinion of having looked at several of the issues. But what does it mean for readers? I think it means, you know, these websites are going throat to throat at each other. It's big business. And that they take very seriously the comments that other people make about their business, like Nikki Fink.
Right. And it's not necessarily against the law to run around telling people that your competitors are on the ropes. But
well, no, it can be. Absolutely.
Well, yeah.
You can't spread false and malicious lies about a business and threaten their business model. You know, you say somebody's about to go out of business when they're not, and you have no basis for saying that. That can be basis for legal action. Absolutely.
Well, like I said, there's not necessarily a law against that, but
there is a law against that. You can't do that. You can't claim someone's going out of business when you have no reason to believe that, or in fact, know the opposite.
Well, okay. I guess we're parsing words here, because the law and whether something is liable, which is different in that case, there's no actual law on the books about it, but you could be sued and lose pretty big.
I don't understand your distinction. There's no law that specifically says Nikki Fink can't say The Hollywood Reporter is going out of business. They didn't pass the don't say your neighbor is going out of business law, but there are laws and statutes on the books that cover such behavior. Absolutely.
The police will show up at your door and you can be charged with a crime for that, as opposed to a civil crime or a civil lawsuit.
It's not illegal if it isn't a criminal act. It may be a civil breaking a civil law, but what's the difference? I didn't say she'd go to jail. I'm saying you can't do it. It's against the law. It doesn't mean that you'll be sued in criminal court and go to jail. You may be fined. You may be sued in civil court. Does that mean it's legal? How can you be sued in civil court, lose $100,000 judgment, and you're still saying, but it's legal because I wasn't put in jail? I don't understand the distinction.
Well, I am sure that our listeners who are hearing this now will be writing into us, trying to explain to us the difference between civil law and criminal law. And if you would like to do that, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That is exactly what James Gardner from Melbourne, Australia did. Now, I'm going to read this.
We get a lot of Australia fans, don't we?
Yeah, we do, actually. And, you know, I happen to know James. I've met him in the past. He writes, "Hello, Sperling. Wanted to mention in the last show, when you and Michael were talking about trends and possible negative ones in cinema, I feel that you failed to get Michael to understand that there is one major worry for the industry. There is a trend in that attendance is either down or not as high as one would expect. Why is this? Well, take your pick. Netflix, torrents, or theft, early release windows. There is a worry that what has happened to companies like Borders and other bookstores will happen to cinema. Bookstores will never go away completely, but then they will never be what they once were. If consumers have so many alternative sources of content, new content, what does this mean for cinema exhibition? A major contraction, like bookstores possibly? Then there is the belief that fragmenting the market so much will also affect the total profitability of films. The more fragmentation that occurs, the less any one film has a chance to make the huge return needed to pay for the typical budget. It is potentially a very big downward spiral. It's a set of trends that has some very worried. James Gardner, Digital, Melbourne, Australia, or maybe as they say in Australia, Melbourne.
Well, James, thanks for writing. I'm afraid what happened was that I failed to get Sperling or you to understand that there is no trend for attendance being down or not as high as one would, not as high as one might expect. Maybe that's so. But the absolute trend of ticket sales from the 70s to today is that every decade they have sold more tickets than the previous decade. And they haven't done it by releasing, twice as many movies. The actual number of movies being released is fairly steady, in fact, a little bit lower. Budgets are sort of trending down a little bit, and Hollywood is selling more tickets than ever in the 2000s than they ever did before the 90s, the 80s, or the 70s. And they did it when they were also doubling their money by making tons of money on DVD and all these alternate ancillary markets. So they were making a lot more money off their movies, despite the fact that they continue to sell as many tickets as they ever have in the modern era. That's a simple fact. There is no drop in attendance if you look at the big picture. Attendance has gone up for four decades in a row. There's a huge upside to the market that never existed before in DVD and online video streaming and all that stuff. Hollywood makes more money off movies than they ever did before, and their core business of getting people to go to the theaters is still very, very healthy. We just had our biggest summer of all time in pure box office dollars, and attendance continues to rise decade by decade as it has since the 70s.
But to James' point, I mean, I know where he's coming from here in regards to keeping it just in the theatrical release window. The exhibitor is really what he's referring to, movie theaters.
Ticket sales are up. That is a fact. There is no trend in attendance going down. You hear that all the time whenever movies don't set a record at the box office. People say, oh my God, attendance is down. It's not. If you look at the big picture, decade by decade, we're selling more tickets now than we have in the past four decades. People continue to buy tickets and go to the movies at the same steady pace, despite the fact that they're spending another $20 billion on DVDs.
Okay, again, we're going to chop it right off at DVDs because that's not what he's referring to.
Ticket sales are up. Attendance is up. And it's keeping pace with population growth. So attendance is not dropping. People say, well, yeah, but there are more people. Yes, that's why ticket sales are up. They're remaining steady as a percentage of population.
I would actually be interested to know what the figure is, because, of course, you hear John Fithian of NATO, a trade group, and other, the MPAA always says that, too, that it's keeping up with the population growth. I'd actually be interested to see those figures, because they never actually present those figures.
They see them all the time. I've looked at them repeatedly online. They do present those figures. Pure ticket sales are presented all the time. It's a straight line from the 70s to today and an upward growth.
Well, maybe we can dedicate a future show to this very topic, but we should probably move on to our next. It's not a letter so much as it came across, it was a comment left on LinkedIn where we post the show every week. And Michael, do you want to read this comment from Mark Frigo?
Sure. This is from Mark Frigo, who calls himself a multi-platinum credit recording engineer and owner of Frigo Recording. Good for him. That sounds like he's had a great career. He's talking about our story about the lapse in copyright law. They passed a copyright law in the late 70s that meant albums released from 1978 onward would revert back to the artist after 35 years, which meant albums released in 78 like Darkness on the Edge of Town by Bruce Springsteen or The Long Run by the Eagles could revert to those artists away from the record companies. And that's all starting to happen. There was a very interesting New York Times article about this.
Right. And we had Larry Roeder on episode 115 to talk about termination rights.
And so Mark Frigo is commenting on this, and he says, I'm assuming that most of these songwriters already own the songwriter's share of the rights, and that what they're attempting to retain is the publisher's share, which in many cases would be owned by their record labels. Does anyone know if this is a correct assumption on my part? The articles I've seen on this subject don't address those details. I realize that in the 60s and prior to that, it was common for the labels to sign deals where they owned all the rights to the song, both the songwriter's and publisher's shares. But by sometime in the 70s, I'm pretty certain that most major acts signed deals where they retained the songwriter's half of the royalties and the label retained the publisher's half. That's from Mark. It's true that fewer and fewer people made the really bad deals that were made in the 50s and 60s where they signed away their publishing all their life to the songs that they wrote. But I'm not sure what the details are on that. Did you look into that, Sperling?
No, I haven't had time. But, also in the 50s and I guess a portion of the 60s. The 60s is really where the singer-songwriter artist was born. In the 50s, you had Elvis Presley and others, of course, but they were singing other people's songs. They didn't write their music necessarily.
That's true. But the songwriters would have made deals as well. And again, they would have lost, a lot of times they lost the rights or gave them up for pennies,
you know, made bad deals. It happened all the time. Blues artists, pop, rock, soul, jazz, you know, a lot of people made very bad publishing deals where they sold away all their publishing rights for, you know, a lump sum early on in their career. And then the publisher, the record company or their manager made tons of money off of it.
Right. And I guess what Mark is saying here is, look, they already own the songwriter's rights.
Right. You know, assuming almost anybody with a deal who came up in the 70s would have retained that. Not always the case, but most smart ones. And certainly once you became a big artist, you would pull back those rights or keep them for the future. And he's saying they already own their songwriter's rights. He assumes they're trying to pull back whatever rights the publishers retain. That's what would revert to them.
Right.
So we'll have to look into that. It's an interesting point as far as one of the little tweaks in this story, which is going to continue for the next 2 or 3 years. I keep seeing little stories about it.
Yeah, it was in Rolling Stone magazine, and you know, Don Henley's been all over the place talking about it. So yeah, I would suspect that you're going to see this story kind of in some form over the next year or two. But both Mark and James, thank you for writing to us either through LinkedIn or to our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You know, you can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or even in your RSS reader. And we encourage you to subscribe, and we encourage you to rate and rank and review the podcast on all of those platforms. You can find those links as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode and all of the links to Mark Berman's work. And thank you very much, Mark, for joining us. You can find everything on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can even find links to our Twitter and Facebook accounts. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. And some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.